One, two, three. In West Philadelphia, born and raised. On the playground is where I spent most of my days. Chilling out, maxing, relaxing, all cooling, all shooting some b-ball outside of the school. When a couple of guys who were up to no good started making trouble in my neighborhood. I got in one little fight. My mom got scared and said, "You're moving with your auntie and Uncle Bel-Air." I whistled for a cab, and when it came near, the license plate had freshened. There was dice in the mirror. If anything I could say to this cab was weird, but I thought, man, forget it. Yo, homes to Bel-Air. Doom, ba-doom, boom. I pulled up to the house about 7 or 8, and I yelled to the cabbie, "Yo, homes, smell you later." Looked at my kingdom, I was finally there to sit on my throne as the Prince of Bel-Air. Obligatory. Yep. Whipping the neck around.
Yep. And this is violating so much copyright law. There's no way this is ever getting into the final cut.
None of this will air anyway, Mason. Not a single minute of this is going to air anyway. Yeah, guys, welcome to Artsy Fartsy Immigrants. I have a very special guest here today. He's very artsy fartsy, but not so much an immigrant, which I think, you know, my show, my rules. Doesn't always have to be. There's been, you know, I was looking at our episode list, and there's been a lot of either or in the last years. Like, either they are artsy fartsy or they are immigrants. It's very special to get both. Mm-hmm. It's not every time.
So then you should amend your statement that I'm not a very special guest. I'm just a special guest.
You're like you're a really good average guest.
Mm-hmm.
You hit the median. Yes. Dude, spot on.
I'm a 75C guest.
If you were a state, you'd be a swing state. You could just go either way.
Like, I want to say Pennsylvania, I think.
You're like a, what do they call it? You're a battleground state. You're like Georgia, uh-huh. I guess.
You know, I'd rather live in one of those.
You think they're more fun?
Well, I just think that, I mean, your vote matters in a swing state. In Louisiana,
right?
If you are not voting for a Republican candidate, your vote goes in the trash can.
Do you think they really don't? I mean, I know that there's gerrymandering, and state's just more red. Yeah, it's just more red.
But
right?
You know, in a national election, it goes to the Electoral College, and all 9 of our Electoral College votes go to whoever has the majority.
What do you think about the Electoral College system? Because that's an interesting thing about living here in Germany now. Is there's far more parties,
mm-hmm.
And again, this particular system is definitely specific to Germany. But you know, they have like a grand, larger mm-hmm. amount of parties, however you mm-hmm. want to say it. And it's just the highest votes. It's just like each person counts as one vote. And I think the way the system is now, post Angela Merkel, is that Olaf Scholz represents the SPD, which is like mildly conservative party,
mm-hmm.
you know, still even a generally conservative party, other than the AfD, which is borderline like a terror group. Like they have just been, like Germany just declared them an attack on democracy. They've, wow. They're like a small, rising, far-right, dangerous group. But the average like conservative is still way more progressive to a general American's eyes anyway. Sure. But like, so there's Olaf Scholz with SPD, and it was matched with one more party, I forget, and the Green Party, which mm-hmm. is, as you can imagine, like very pro environment.
All things green.
Mm-hmm. All things green, yeah. Yep. And the way that it functions is the percentages in which they were voted for account for how much power they, I'm sure I'll be corrected, but like how much power they influence. So the thing is, these three that were voted the most have to work together and have to confer with each other and make compromises to make law.
Sounds good.
Yeah. And like in theory, it sounds pretty good. I think there's a lot of course, politics are very divisive no matter where you live.
Yeah.
But what do you think about the electoral college system?
You know, first off, I love that we are right out of the gate with politics. Just we wasted no time.
You and me too, which is funny because I know little.
We've talked zero politics this whole visit.
We were doing British accents before I hit record. Oh, here we go.
And then we did the Fresh Prince rap.
Yeah, in West Philadelphia.
But honestly, I know it's like the popular opinion to say the Electoral College is dumb. And it's, I also know that I'm pretty sure, because I've read papers before about like arguing for the Electoral College, and to be quite frank, I do not feel nearly educated enough on the subject to have a good opinion worth distributing to the public in such a form as this,
especially not on a
podcast that everybody like listens to.
Yeah, this is not like name the other person who does something better. That's what I'm thinking of, but anyway.
But I guess to take a step more broad, and also to touch on what you were just saying, I feel like this system that you're describing with more parties must be better than a two-party system.
Right? I mean, even if it's not a perfect system, I think what bothers me, even before I moved, is that just your vote does not count as an addition to the percentage.
Yeah.
You know, I don't get this thing about... Again, yeah, I think you're right that it's not so black and white. I think that's the trouble with America on a lot of issues, is that it's just actually so enormous.
Mm-hmm. It's a huge place.
It's so big. And I've seen more and more Europeans on TikTok and stuff who travel to the States for the first time, and they have a bit of an epiphany, and they say, oh, we kind of get now why a lot of Americans don't travel out, because there's just too much to see as it is. Mm-hmm. Even comedians I listen to talk about, like, yeah, man, like, I mean, by the time you hit more or less every major city and then the medium-sized towns and stuff on a tour, you're so exhausted.
You've been touring for 2 years.
Yeah. And then you've got to think about, well, now we got to spend the money to go to the UK or, you know, if they have an audience in other countries as well. You have to like make that effort and make that choice and spend the investment on doing it. And it's just such a big place. So maybe a system like we have in Germany isn't the perfect one for something of that size. Again, I can't imagine a system where one person's vote counts being an issue, or like being something that would not be good.
Yeah.
But then you'd have to, with a lot of things, I think, and maybe we'll get into it, maybe not, but with a lot of things about America, the more and more I live abroad, there are just so many things in place that would have to be scrapped from top to bottom and restructured completely, which will simply never happen.
Yeah.
You just don't have the money. You don't have the people interested enough. You don't have people who can convince the system to change.
Yeah.
The people who care enough, it's too small of a minority.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like it's not out of the realm of likelihood that in our lifetime we could see the U.S. becoming a not so U.S., you know, like more, California, they say, has been like threatening to secede from the union for years,
and
Texas as well, you know. I don't know. I mean, I don't think it's I wouldn't be surprised if we see the dissolution of the union in some capacity.
Dude, countries alike and states have been threatening that for so long. Mm-hmm. Like, I remember when Obama was elected, people claimed they would secede, because states, you know, would thought the same thing. And when Bush won, you know, a lot of left-leaning celebrities claimed they would leave the country. It's just it's very, like, dramatic stuff.
Yeah.
When Trump pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement, the UN started in itself to, or the EU started to crack under the constant, like under the new, you know, atmosphere, the zeitgeist.
Yeah.
And France threatened to leave the EU for a while there. I don't even know what's going on with that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they didn't thus far, but my goodness, you know, what a dramatic thing to think about doing, you know?
Well, here's the real question is, what is the U.S.'s Brexit going to be called? It can't be called Brexit.
U.S.
Like when states start seceding from the union.
It'd be like U.S. and then out of here. U.S. out of here.
Or us out of here.
Us out of here. With like a little fine print of Thor about it. Oh, us?
Out of here. Don't worry about it.
Don't worry about it, Tim.
Yeah, forget about it.
Oh, my God. Mason, man, jumping into a fun topic. We We've known each other for, I guess it's probably been, this is 2024, we've probably known each other for...
2011, I'd say.
Yeah, I was going to say like 12, 13 years. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because we were in the University of New Orleans. Did we meet in the improv group?
That's what I think. I think I remember meeting you and our mutual friend Danny Abel in one of the, I mean, there were tryouts, right? There were auditions for the improv team.
I was so nervous for that. I remember my audition.
I think that's when I met y'all, was the tryouts for the improv team. And you two were already kind of a unit. And I remember being like, yeah, those guys are fucking funny. Can we curse on this, by the way?
Of course, you say whatever you want.
Yeah. All right.
I remember the audition room. I didn't remember being with Danny, but it does make sense. Mm-hmm. Danny and I, yeah, we met as roommates in the dorms and then had all the, of course, we both studied film. So we mm-hmm. had the same classes and the same interests. We had a lot of the same groups at first. There was a good stretch there. Like you said, we were just one unit. Mm-hmm. Like we were always in the dorms together. And then when he moved to Lakeview Terrace, mm-hmm. I was there constantly with a lot of other improv people.
Those are good apartments. I have like lots of fond memories of those apartments. I would still live there probably, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I never did, but if I were looking for a place to live. Yeah.
I was definitely jealous there for a while. My living situation in New Orleans, I feel like it changed all the time. Maybe it just changed two or three times, but... like those college years, it feels like everything is sort of fleeting and flowing away and you have to kind of mm-hmm. just grab on and hold tight. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was, I guess, 2011 or so, 2010 maybe even.
Yeah. 2010 was the fall of 2010 was my first year there, my first Same. Semester there, I guess.
Same.
But I feel like we didn't cross paths, at least in my first semester.
No, I guess not. Yeah. I guess not. Maybe we saw each other in the dorms or something. Because you lived in North Hall.
I lived in North Hall, but no, and I hung out with no one. I had no friends. Every Friday, I would, my treat to myself, is I would take the bus down to the theaters at Canal Place in the mall there, which doesn't exist.
Like the cinema.
The cinema, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that cinema, at least, I could be wrong, but I think that cinema's gone.
Canal Place with the reclined red seats is gone?
I think so.
I think
that theater's no more. I don't know. It could still be there in some other form. But yeah, I would go there every Friday and treat myself to a movie.
It's kind of sad. Mm-hmm. Why do you think you struggled making friends in that? I mean, making friends in a new school is very tough. Do you think it was just natural things?
Maybe. You know, I'm a shy person and I don't really, I'm not good at talking to people I don't know. So that's probably part of it, but I don't know. I guess
I
needed
you nice
that.
And liquored up for this one anyway.
Yep.
It's the only way you'd agree to it.
Yeah, I didn't have improv yet. You know, I think I needed a forum to meet people. Yeah.
At that time, were you focused on being an actor already?
Yeah, probably because I got really into theater in high school. Yeah. Did my first play in ninth grade mm-hmm. in Alexandria. And then started going to high school in Natchitoches the year after that and got immediately into the theater there. And by the time I was a senior, I had sort of filled that slot, like that the shoes of like the male theater senior, you know?
How so? In what way?
Oh, I was doing all of the plays, all of them.
You were just in everything available.
Yeah.
Were you past the point of needing to audition at that point?
I mean, I don't know that. I think it was always one of those situations where I think everyone who auditioned got to do something, you know?
Mm-hmm. So Alexandria was where you were born and raised.
Yep.
Alexandria, Louisiana.
Yep.
And that's closer to Baton Rouge?
No. It's about 2.5 hours from Baton Rouge, 3.5 hours from New Orleans.
Yeah. So it's more...
It's in the center of the boot. It's the dead center of the boot.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. I've never been there before. I think the most I left really... I mean, besides Baton Rouge itself and Slidell, I think the most I'd ventured out of New Orleans in my time there was Lafayette, which I guess is totally opposite direction of Alexandria.
It's I mean, because of the way the roads are, it's technically on the way from Baton Rouge to Alexandria.
Okay.
There's a shortcut you can take through... through small towns, but mm-hmm. but if you're on the interstate going, if you want to take the interstate from Baton Rouge to from Baton Rouge to Alexandria, it takes you through Lafayette.
You started there, and then what was the town you moved to?
Natchitoches, which is about 45 minutes. It's spelled Natchitoches.
Okay, okay. Natchez? C-H-E-S?
It's actually, yes, it's actually the oldest settlement in the entire Louisiana Purchase.
This looks like the quarter.
Older than New Orleans by 3 years.
Really?
Yeah, New Orleans was founded in 1718. Natchitoches was founded in 1715.
Why Natchitoches? Why is Natchitoches famous? Well known for the filming of Steel Magnolias.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Steel Magnolias house is like a bed and breakfast now, I think.
It's known as the City of Lights. Isn't Paris known as the City of Lights?
Yeah, well, Natchitoches is really the Paris of the United States.
You going to sit on that one?
That's because...
You slid that in so nice.
That's because every Christmas, they have this huge... light display at the river, Cane River, mm-hmm. which is not a river, it's an Oxbow Lake.
It's not a river, it's a pond.
Yeah. But it's kind of like, it's
a puddle.
You said it's like the French Quarter. Really, downtown Natchitoches feels,
this picture is
it's shaped a lot like downtown. I mean, it's shaped a lot like the French Quarter. It's like that very rigid block system with like Front Street, Second Street, so forth, mm-hmm. that front the river, you know?
It is the oldest permanent European settlement within the borders of the 1803 Louisiana Purchase.
That's what I just said, Jordan.
Oh, sorry, I'm not listening. Is this, it was, let's see, explored by Louis Jutero de Saint Denis.
Yeah.
Is that right? Do you think you coming up in this region is why you had such an interest in French for so long?
Yeah, that's probably that. I'd say that's probably true.
I think that makes a lot of sense, right?
I think a part of me knew that it was kind of bogus, but once when I was in the 12th grade, I made like I don't even know why, but I made a video about like why you should take French in school.
In high school,
a commercial just for French class.
For French class to promote French class?
Really, not even class, just a commercial for the French language.
Did anyone ask you to make this?
I don't remember. I want to say sign, maybe
Mason.
Not.
That's not a good sign, Mason. It makes sense why you had no friends when you went to UNO.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm just kidding.
Well, also,
I had friends either, man.
All of my, most of my classmates at that school in Natchitoches, because it's kind of like a gifty school. Most of them went out of state, like
once they graduated.
Like they went to, a lot of them went to like big Ivy League schools or just like really, really, really upscale like private small liberal arts schools. Yeah.
So you know that when you're in Alexandria and Natchitoches, which of all the places to come from, those look and or are spelled so cool. Mm-hmm. You're focused on acting. Then what's leading you to UNO? Particularly, I mean, I know they had a great film program that triggered me, but were you thinking like, this is close enough with a good program enough, or what guided you there?
It was 100% my fallback school.
It was a plan B.
D. It was like I don't think I applied to another school like lower in the barrel than UNO. But
this was like the first college I saw, and I was in love with it. Like, couldn't have dragged me to a dumpster more filthy than this pile of shit New World School. But I thought I could come help.
No, really, probably a more accurate statement is that it was the only public school that I applied to.
What was your dream? What was your
Yeah, yeah. So it goes back to this high school I went. It's called Louisiana School for Math, Science, and the Arts. It's on the campus of Northwestern State University in Natchitoches. And it has this vibe of like a small liberal arts college. We were on a college schedule, you know, like unlike most high school students.
Oh, that's awesome.
You know, I had like Monday, Wednesday, Friday classes. I had Tuesday, Thursday classes. Mm. I lived in a dorm. I had to wake myself up and get to class, you know.
So you were really like forced to be responsible from a much younger age.
From 15, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. Okay.
And I thought that's more of what I wanted. You know, that high school had 300 students and we were all very close because we were all living on a college campus without our parents. You know, we had RAs and you know, the faculty of the school and everything. But anyway, so that's what I thought I wanted. So I applied to small liberal arts colleges mostly. And I almost went to Centenary College.
What's Centenary College?
In Shreveport.
Is that the name of it?
It's called Centenary, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is it focused on theater arts? Or
they had a really, really good theater arts program at the time. I had seen a couple of their productions. I saw a production of Metamorphosis there, which was so good. I mean, it was really good when I was 17. If I watched it now, I don't know if it would be as good. But at that time, wow, that was a great production. I really wanted to go see that. I mean, I really wanted to go to that school. And I was this close to going to Centenary. It was expensive. All the other schools I applied to were really expensive.
Of course,
the problem, right?
Yeah.
But I got enough scholarships from that school that we would just be paying like $7,000 out of pocket per semester, which is still a lot of money.
Dude, that's a shit ton.
And maybe it was like $7,000 per academic year, but anyway, it was like a few thousand dollars, right?
Sure.
Average
family.
In the 11th hour, I got a full scholarship to UNO, and I was like, well, even at that age, I was like sensible minded enough to say, well, I'm not going to turn down a free ride. So I went to UNO instead. And the moral of the story is I ended up loving it. I'm so glad that I went to a larger, even like UNO is not a huge school. It's like,
no,
14,000
villagey
right?
in a sense almost.
Yeah. But I'm so glad that I went to a larger school, a larger public school where I could be a little more anonymous.
Right. Right.
Than another small liberal arts school. Yeah.
That's so interesting, man. And do you think like this maturity, because this is something that I've told you many times that for me isn't the only key definition of how I imagine you when I see you in like an abstract space, but like your ability to kind of hunker down and say like, this is what I got to do. So I'm going to do it. That's how I've always known you to be. Mm. And when you're like 18 meeting someone, it's fascinating to know someone like that. When you're mm-hmm. someone like me mm-hmm. who comes from very sheltered, naive sort of background where mm-hmm. like anything that's different is like, oh, whoa, no way. You mm-hmm. know, did that like with choosing the full ride and with how you felt as a student before UNO, how much of a hand did your parents have in that or if any?
Oh, very much. Yeah. I've always been close with my parents. And they've always had like a really strong effect, I think, on who I am. We, of course, you know, we were talking about politics a moment ago. We don't agree on everything. I mean, naturally, if you
sure.
are in your 30s and you grew up in the South, you don't agree with your parents. You know, like that's...
I mean, anywhere, probably,
yeah.
more
yeah,
or
less. Yeah, that's true, yeah. But I still have a whole lot of respect for my parents and a lot of love, of course, as well. And yeah. so, yeah, but I think, I think a lot of that rationality... came from them. They're both like very do what you have to do kind of people, you know.
What do your parents do for a living?
So they are retired now, but they were both teachers at one point, which I always say when I'm like, you know, I became a teacher and I feel like it's no, you know, not an accident that both of my parents were teachers as well.
What did they teach?
So before I was born, my mother taught high school math.
Oh, cool.
Like algebra, geometry, that kind of stuff.
I always liked my math teachers, you know? Yeah.
And I think she maybe taught one more academic year, half an academic year after I was born, mm-hmm. But then changed careers. Took some time off to be a mother and then
yeah.
And then changed careers and became like a financial analyst for this big hospital company. It's like
that's there. A big switch up. That's a big change.
But you know, I mean, it was still very numbers oriented. She spent. I remember in my childhood, like watching her work, it pretty much just seemed like she was in Excel spreadsheets up to her eyes all day long. You know.
Yeah.
And my father, he sort of, so he got his master's degree in special education, specializing in severe profound handicaps. So
what's severe profound?
Severe profound. It's like it's one of like three, I think, ratings.
It'd be fun if you just like perfectly described me mm-hmm. right now and I'd be like, sure. Uh-huh. No way, huh?
Basically, his training was most in working with students with like cerebral palsy, muscular dystrophy, just severe or profound handicaps.
Okay. Yeah. Like defining.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And so he did that in high schools for a while, and then eventually landed in this place. And I think he got here maybe before I was born as well, a place called Louisiana Special Education Center, which had like permanent residence. And so he taught there in my childhood. And then by the time he retired, he had sort of climbed the ladder to be the administrator of that facility.
Are they still working? He hated that.
He hated that the latter end where he was an administrator, because he had to like drive to Baton Rouge and defend the budget, and
I was less hands on and more the business part.
Exactly. He didn't get to work with the students anymore.
I would hate
that
too.
Yeah.
Is he retired now?
Yeah, both retired.
Mm-hmm. Both retired. How old are your parents?
Well, my dad was born in 55. My mom was born in 61. So
my dad's 61, my mm-hmm. mom's 63.
Yeah.
So yes,
mom was not a retirement age. She chose to retire like at a lower, I guess, pension when my dad retired, so that they could retire together.
Oh, that's kind of nice.
Yeah.
And they both are happy with the decisions they made about that?
They are, yeah, yeah. They moved out of Alexandria, and they've got this beautiful place in Vegas. in Northwest Arkansas.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, you told me they moved to Arkansas now. That's crazy. That makes a lot of sense. It really helps like paint the picture of how you became this guy that we met in improv, because mm-hmm. it was so funny, like, I'm really so happy that our friendship has lasted this long, because it gives us the chance to look at these crazy years and still be so proud of them, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Meeting at UNO, I was this like doughy-eyed, couldn't get more naive and helpless as a kid, like going from a very small town in Mississippi, you know, hyper-conservative, hyper-Christian, very sheltered, you know, going into a whole thing about my dad's like a whole episode, but very, you know, lovely mother and, you know, like complicated relationship with dad, but like still this good family. Like it wasn't like a destroyed family bubble. And then, you know, teenager graduating high school, dad gets a new job at Bow Brothers mm-hmm. in New Orleans.
Okay,
18, mm-hmm. like leaving everything that I thought I was going to do, like leaving all my friends, mm-hmm. took a gap year. So I would have actually started mm-hmm. college 1 year before you,
mm-hmm.
Took a gap year. And in that year just worked, you know, just made friends in Slidell through music, through hanging out at cafes, meeting young people, and working a couple of different delis, working at a steakhouse, something else. And then finally, yeah, like scouting schools and then checked out. I mean, the only thing that I could ever, there's also this, I think there's this problem, another problem with America generally as a culture, is like you're forced to go into a blanket education system needing to know exactly what you're going to be the rest of your life.
Yeah.
And that's tough, man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, listening to Mariana and Johanna talk about like the system here, and it seemed very cool. You can study for as long as you want to.
Yeah,
and you don't. Yeah, I don't know. I couldn't regurgitate everything that was described, but it seemed very interesting.
These are some German friends of mm-hmm. mine, and like the system, you know, probably has some small little rules to play by. I'm sure, because that's how Germany works. But mm-hmm. like. I knew, you know, I worked in Munich. One of my first jobs was at this beautiful third wave coffee shop that was all like glass, steel, mm-hmm. and handcrafted wood, and then just like the finest Ethiopian and Colombian coffees. Like it was a really nice coffee place to work at. I really liked it. And man, they you know, they paid my insurance. Sick leave was no problem at all. And I could take time off for concerts
mm-hmm.
and like a really decent hourly rate. And I had a friend for a while there, definitely was like not a more long-term friendship, but a friend with a guy who worked there, and he was a student at the local art academy,
mm-hmm.
which, as you've seen some buildings around Munich in the last few days, is just one of those gorgeous,
sure.
you know, 3-4 stories tall, like marble pillared buildings,
mm-hmm.
you know, very pre-war, just Roman-esque, you know?
Yeah.
And you imagine this guy going in there. And one or two times maybe I visited him at the school after work. We finished closing. I took the train to the school. And you just go in this mind-blowing, gorgeous place that you imagine seeing in some sort of movie about, you know, the hyper-wealthy Nepo babies having, mm-hmm. like, romantic issues or something, mm-hmm. like this crazy place from my perspective. And going in there, and he's, I don't know, he was probably like 7 or 8 years older than me. Mm-hmm. So at the time, let's say I'm 27, so he's like 34, mm-hmm. you know, and he's just still studying. And I go in his warehouse, he has like his own,
wow.
you know, all the students share like these pretty big warehouse spaces. You go into mm-hmm. the academy, you open a key with a door, and it's this huge barren space with a million windows. Which, of course, they smoke in the windows.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. No one bats an eye about having a beer, smoking a joint.
Yeah.
And there's just, he was just like taking cloth and getting it wet in mm-hmm. paint and just tossing it at something.
Yeah.
And there was another person who just was like breaking the legs off of wooden chairs and putting them in different things. And I thought, this is so crazy.
Yeah.
That this is what he's doing at 34.
Man. If we still had that option, like if, I mean,
yeah,
if it weren't so expensive, yeah, I'd still be taking classes.
I would have definitely, yeah, I would, yeah. I definitely would have stayed longer at UNO.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a problem, like, I might have made that sound negative, but like, I was so jealous, I guess. Mm-hmm. I think I was just jealous.
Yeah.
Because I definitely, although I'm, again, like you, very happy mm-hmm. I went to UNO, and the people is really almost like triple what the education meant to me.
Mm-hmm.
But the education was also good and the opportunities were good. And I think if I had had more freedom in the way that everybody does here,
mm-hmm.
man, I don't know. Maybe I think the thing is people like me take longer to realize that that what they have is good.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of students are like that at a young age.
What do you mean by people like you in that sense?
I've always been someone who, not to like reuse descriptors over and over, but like just naive. Like, you know, mm-hmm. you go into college and I was taking advantage of like these incredible educational opportunities. You know, mm-hmm. the freshman year I was screwing around. I was, you know, I loved a few classes a lot. I had like mm-hmm. early freshman philosophy classes, poetry mm-hmm. class, creative writing class, and then of course, you know, like film theory or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you weren't forced to go into that school knowing this is what you're going to get, you have to hurry right now and you have to be done in, you know, let's say 4 years on yeah. average. I think I would have needed a couple years to realize like, okay, all mm-hmm. right, let's get it together. Yeah. Let's maybe even take yeah. a class again.
Totally.
You know?
If you didn't have a degree plan that there's so much pressure to stick to and to follow, and you actually just got to choose what you wanted to learn for the next 6 months, you know?
Yeah.
Or I guess 4 months more accurately, but that would be so cool.
Yeah.
If that were your college, if that were all of our college experience where you just every 4 months you're picking what you want to spend the next chunk of your life learning about.
You know? Yeah, exactly. And there's strange rules about, you know, something they don't do here, which I'm also a little bit jealous of, is let's say you decide, okay, I don't really know what I want to do yet, but mm-hmm. I know I want to study film.
Mm-hmm.
Don't know if I'm going to be a DP or a first AD yeah. or a writer or whatever, but I need to get into film. I love that world. And I need to learn if I really like that world, because mm-hmm. it's only until you study that you realize the gritty details, and that can turn people off.
Yeah.
And something they don't do here that they did do at UNO and a lot of schools that I don't like is you finally get out of high school, you finally say, oh, I can join this amazing film program, and you get there and they say, cool, you can take one class this semester, but you're going to have to take biology,
mm-hmm.
you're going to have to take another elective,
yeah,
you're going to have to take, you know, whatever, math mm-hmm. and this other things. And I was like, I'm sorry, but why do I need another, like, beginner's level biology?
Yeah.
Why do I need high school again?
Yeah.
If I'm here, mm-hmm. I'm here. Give me wall-to-wall film classes for the next 4 years.
Yeah.
I want to go in so deep that there's no choice but to learn.
Great point.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And they do that here. They say, okay, you're done. You're going to start your class now. Maybe there's some exceptions, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But you go in, you're like, okay, well, that's what you want to focus on. So that's where you focus.
Yeah.
I think it's crazy that I didn't even think about it at the time. I thought when you're that young and you come from high school and you join a school where they teach things like that, you just kind of feel that it's normal. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I was older and, of course, met Ify or, like, you know, spoke to people who weren't from the States who were like, why are we taking... And then, of course, from their perspective, they're like, but this is for kids. Mm-hmm. This is, like, the basics. We all know this stuff. So maybe it was good that I, you know, had it again. But, again, it was like, maybe mm-hmm. if the earlier school system had been better...
Yeah.
By the time we get to the college programs...
Yeah. Man, and when you come from Louisiana and Mississippi public school education, the bottom in the whole country, you know?
I think Mississippi is still the lowest, right?
I think Louisiana is right above it.
Is it?
Yeah.
Yeah, Mississippi's got a lot of awards, you know? I think it's like...
a lot of Razzies.
A lot of sweaty high fives for as most obese and worst education and, like, mm-hmm. I don't know, most there's like four or five of just like woof, there we go.
I don't even like driving through Mississippi, honestly. I'm just kidding, that was a joke.
But you know, there's a few stops along the way you're like, let's fill it up, let's go. It's funny balance. I think you can appreciate that too, is like about the South, is just that, sure, the landscape, the physical environment can be so breathtakingly beautiful. Hmm. Those Louisiana sunsets, the Spanish moss, the mm-hmm. rivers, the rolling, you know, cornfields of Mississippi, the, you know, the oak trees, that blue, like, Memphis grass.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. It's like, it can be so beautiful, but it's almost like you're forced to pay the price of it in mm-hmm. a sense, because, or maybe that's the wrong way to think about it, but just like I found that when I do travel back and go through it, I think, like, man, it's so gargantuan,
mm-hmm.
such like open, boundless fields, and it can be such a beautiful thing, but no one there is really setting up opportunities for people to go and appreciate it as much. Maybe, I don't know. I mean, of course, it depends who you are and where you are. The hard thing also about the States, as with everywhere, is generalizing.
Yeah.
It's just person to person.
Because it's so big.
It's just so big, mm-hmm. man. Like, not every German loves to camp or hike or, you know, ski, but a lot of them do. Sure, a lot of them do. But let's go back to the first, the first time we met. I guess do you remember that audition? Do you remember being in there? I don't remember what I did.
I mean, how well can we trust our memories here? But I feel like I remember it being in a classroom.
Mine was in the...
I think we met in the second round. You know what I mean? Oh. Like the callbacks or something. That's what I'm...
Okay.
Because yes, I do remember us... initially auditioning separately, and then, or maybe it was, maybe it was just like the first rehearsal.
I think Danny went before me, and I thought, well, he's got it.
I should go. I'm sorry.
I excuse me.
Yeah. I mean, Danny is one of the funniest people alive. So that makes sense. Yeah.
He's punishingly funny.
Yeah.
It's unreal.
But I feel like the first, whatever situation I'm thinking of, whether it was a callback or a first rehearsal or whatever, I remember it being in a classroom, I think.
Yeah, we did a lot of classrooms back in the day.
And like, I feel like I remember being a lot of people there. Mm-hmm. So like, maybe it was still a...
Who's that first group that you remember?
Oh, the one before that I have no memory of.
I remember still one of my very first rehearsals. I don't remember if you were there or not. Was still with Ben Matheny.
Hmm.
First round, Ben, Robert Fascio was still mm-hmm. a student.
Mm-hmm.
Or still, like, he wasn't leading it yet.
Grad student yet, yeah.
Or still, wasn't grad studenting. But otherwise, for me, the get-go group, or at least the core at some point within a year, was you, me, Danny, Susan.
Mm-hmm. Matthew Ethan Carmichael.
Carmichael, man. I had moments where I loved him and moments where I hated him, but I never thought he wasn't funny.
Yeah, I think on the whole, I look back, I guess what's the word I'm trying to say? Favorably on Carmichael.
Yeah.
I just liked him, yeah.
The only issue I think I ever had was so particular to the time where I was like, I was the, Corey had left and I was voted as improv leader.
Oh, that was after I was gone.
You were out too.
Oh, okay.
I was voted in as the like improv.
How did I not know that? Wow. You were the leader of improv.
I was voted in after Corey left.
I had no idea.
And I really wanted it. I was so hungry for it. And this was exactly at the same time when that, what's that improv theater that kind of took over the Bible?
The New Movement,
which, you know, fine.
Do you know what happened with them?
No.
I mean, I don't know all the facts, but it's gone. It was gone a few years ago because the founders apparently, allegedly.
Hemorrhaging money?
No, just were fucking everybody.
Oh. Well, that's not what I thought you were going to say at all.
I know.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, okay, wow.
And it was, I feel like they kind of went down with me too, even though it was a married couple. It was a man and a woman in charge. I feel like New Movement kind of went down with me too. Yeah.
Good. Good. I'm glad they're gone.
They are not there anymore. Yeah.
Their impression on the city at the time, like for those,
it was huge. Oh man,
It was so punishing.
Did you take the first class with them?
I took. Yeah, me. And
I did
Danny,
too. Yeah.
I think maybe you were in our group.
We might have been in the same one. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I remember Danny, and we took one. It was so expensive. We didn't go to the next round.
Mm-hmm. And, I know that's insane.
And then yeah. Carmichael did, and then that was the whole thing at the time. Like, so okay, just briefly, like for those who don't know. The improv group that Mason and I are talking about in our school was a, you know, voluntarily auditioned comedic improvisational comedy group,
yeah.
Which meant that our leader, Corey, who we still deeply admire, a good friend of ours, was the leader, and he created and suggested short form games primarily. So if you've ever seen the show Whose Line Is It Anyway, these are very quickly digestible, very entertaining. It's called short form, these kinds of games. And we loved performing them and practicing them. And it was really like building these relationships and, you know, exercising your brain. The New Movement, which was kind of this hot, sassy, you know, corporate feeling thing, like when Good Burger had that Bitburger place, the Megatron, whatever place across the street. It was just this new thing, and everyone got very quickly convinced that this was the only way to do it, and that's long form improv, which is just a different muscle.
Yeah, I mean, they were kind of trying to become like the UCB or the Groundlings of New Orleans.
UCB being United Citizens Brigade, which was like improv groups from Chicago that, you know, brought people out of the woodworks, like Amy Poehler and. That like, I mean, a lot of SNL cats from like the 07-06 cast, you know, like these early, so like long form being, you know, not only establishing jokes, but establishing character and arc and story and callback. Some people love it and live by it. Like I've seen Ask Cat, this UCB thing, and that's genius.
Tina Fey was a part of that.
Tina Fey, you know, you can obviously appreciate it. It's just such a muscle. And I think about like Ben Schwartz doing his thing, nowadays. Anyway, but like these people came in and it's not really, the issue wasn't really with long form. It was just that they came in and it was like, oh, that's gospel now. Mm-hmm. And they were so expensive offering these classes on how to learn that method. And they just kind of came in like the city was just like, well, if you do improv, you need to be doing New Movement. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And there was a little window there where after Corey left, I was voted in as the improv, I don't know if you say coach or group leader or whatever, but I was so happy to be able to come in. And I literally just kind of carbon copied what Corey taught us. I like felt, and I was calling him for advice. I was asking about suggestions on, you know, exercises, like things like some people might know, like zip, zap, zop, just these little quick brain warm ups and little games that we could try for shows. And when I was that, I was immediately targeted as just not doing the right job by Carmichael, who had been brainwashed by the New Movement.
I missed all this because I was gone. Wow.
Yeah, you were totally out of the picture for that. And it was a really tense, you know, maybe it was just a couple of months.
Very uncomfortable.
It was I was so mad at him. And in the end, what happened was that he had, and it was still like Game of Thronesy in a sense, like he had basically convinced everybody on the team that I was slowing down the progression of the group and keeping us from getting to these bigger stages and bigger opportunities by not forcing us all to do the new movement. And in the end, I like told the group, I was like, I can't do this anymore. I feel the pressure is not right. It's not fun for me. And I quit in a rehearsal and asked who would else would want to do it. And he took his hand up and he was voted in and Carmichael took over. And that also didn't last long. You know?
Yeah. I had no idea of any of this. Wow. Mm-hmm. I didn't know you went. That's traumatic because that was like a, that improv group was like a wonderful, safe place for us. And so for that to have turned on you in your last year.
Yeah. I had such a sour taste. It really sucks.
I get that, man. I get that.
Corey really, I've talked about this guy on the podcast before named Todd, who owned this record store in my hometown, who became like Corey in many ways, like just for music. You know, he showed me like Elliot Smith and Flaming Lips and just stuff I never would have found on my own in this, you know, Mississippi town. And, you know, it's like being given the keys to his record store. Mm-hmm. And then someone coming in and being like, well, you're not promoting the right movies and you're not, you know, marketing the company right. And I'm like, but I'm just trying to.
You like hacky music.
Yeah. What are you playing? You're scaring the customers and then convincing everyone to like vote you out of it. But I've totally like telling the story now is fun because I haven't thought about that in so long.
Yeah.
But I, of course, forgive him. And I'm sure that at the time he thought he was doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. And in hindsight now, it has nothing to do with how ridiculously funny he could really be.
Yeah.
He was
a funny guy.
Painfully funny. Mm-hmm. You guys should imagine this. Like, Mason and I have more or less dressed kind of the same way that we do for a long time. Like, you know, slacks, t-shirts, hoodies. Mm-hmm. I've gotten more into button-ups as the years have gone by, but just, you know, jeans, slacks, hoodies, shirts. Carmichael, if you can imagine this guy after telling that story, always wore polo, like frat shirts.
The one with the alligator on it? Is that, what is that? Ellis? Something like that? Has the little alligator on it. Anyway. The Sperry's, the boat shoes, right?
The boat shoes with no socks. Mm-hmm. Alligator polo shirt label. What was that? Lacoste.
Lacoste.
So he was wearing Lacoste, you know, green polos with the collar up and pink ones with the collar up, tucked into brown shorts with a belt and no sock boat shoes. Mm-hmm. Always kept his hair short and was mysteriously not gay, which just blew me away for a long time. He was very.
It was that.
He just had this very like.
Very preppy energy.
You know, he just had this energy that I was like, I don't get it. But then in the end, it was like, okay, fine, whatever. But he, that guy, the frat guy took over the group and it just didn't make any sense. It's crazy that spawned into all that.
You know, I got really, at that time, I was really close. Well, maybe the time you're talking about was, maybe had ended, but I got really close with Robert Fascio, who was in the generation above us in improv and was also a leader of the group, I think, alongside Corey for a while, at least de facto.
Oh, you know what? It was Corey, Robert, then me.
Yeah.
It was after Robert. I forgot that.
Okay. And Robert and I, who were like besties at that point, also, like, even though we were both kind of maybe a little suspect of the new movement just because it was so expensive. It was like, it's probably not that. And when you're 19, it's really expensive. I mean, I guess we were.
But it is. I mean, several hundred dollars.
A couple hundred dollars a class, I'd say.
Yeah.
Which is not terrible, but still, like.
But still.
It felt like a lot of money when you're making nothing, when you're not making.
When you're literally living off of like a few hundred bucks a month.
Right.
Yeah.
But no, I'd say at that time, both of us, myself included, were very much on that train that, and not necessarily along with the new movement, but just in general, that long-form improv was the more artistic.
Sure. Right?
It was the more literary kind of improv, where you could essentially just improvise a one-act play. You know?
Right. Because you see things like they use the history of UCB, these established comedic sort of masterworks and groups to make you think, well, if you're not doing exactly what they're doing, then what are you doing?
Yeah.
You know, which is really convincing when you're young. You're like, well, I want to be where Amy Poehler is. I want to be where Tina Fey is. But if I don't do that, I won't get there. Okay. Mm-hmm. Let's move from that. When you, my clearest memory of you, throughout improv, of course, and then for a long time after, was as a very determined and my personal favorite, but maybe I'm biased, but my personal favorite and a very determined, very practiced, studied, you know, theater and film actor. Can you kind of walk me through going into that process, like some plays and or short films you did that you have fond memories of, and then maybe when things started to change out of that?
Yeah. Well, I think I referenced a little while ago that it started in ninth grade. I did a play, just sort of on a whim, again, like trying to find my, you're ninth grade, you're trying to find your place in high school, you're trying to figure out, I tried the soccer team, and I was like, you know, shirts and skins, no thank you.
Dude, I had the exact same thing with basketball. I was so glad that they just chose skins. I was like, oh my God.
I was a defender on the team, and you know, if I were unlucky enough that the ball would come to me, I would just like spasmodically kick it as far as I could away from it, usually into the hands of the other team.
Directly into the coach's head.
Just like,
oh, I'm so sorry.
Could not find my place there. But I had a senior mentor when I was in ninth grade, who was on the soccer team and on the improv team.
You're kidding. Wow.
And he was like, hey, you should come to, oh my God, I just remembered. It was while we were running laps around the track, which also, big surprise, wasn't good at.
I was horrible at that.
So I was the last child running around this track.
Yeah.
And this senior ran it with me that last lap. He was a wonderful person.
Did you find it great or did you find it like pitiful?
No. I was comforted by it at the time.
That's great.
And while on this jog, he told me about improv auditions. And so after that day at the track, I never went back to soccer practice.
That's amazing.
And I went to improv auditions that week, I guess, and found my home there. From improv, I think that was sort of my lily pad to a play. We did Lil Abner, and I got a part that I really wanted to play that I didn't think I was going to get. But I left that school the following year to go to this place in Natchitoches, and I got into a play there. And so it was really in plays that I found my joy.
That was your acting. First love.
Yeah, in plays. And then, but going to UNO, which is much more of a, I mean, there's, the theater program was good, but that department was much more of a film-focused department overall, I'd say, right?
Yeah. let me take a quick pee break right there.
You betcha.
And we'll be right back. So we were talking.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead. Yes.
So I got to UNO, and so I started, you know, auditioning for short films and things that all of my friends were making, and made a lot of good memories doing that.
Were your early friends also actors, like through the theater group?
I mean, I think all of the actors in the theater group were also probably auditioning for short films. Probably.
Was your like original dream when you went there, film actor or theater, or like, let's just see what happens?
You know what? Yeah, I mean, even though I fell in love with it on stage, it was by that point probably a dream of being a film actor, just because that's much more part of our daily lives than theater actors.
Seeing
theater, we see films and TV all over the place, and that's what I thought I wanted to do. And I think there were a lot of red flags to me early on about that as a career.
Yeah.
Like even little things like actors can't get tattoos. Actors, you know, have to be very careful with like getting a haircut, or they have to get new headshots. And like, I don't know. And then of course, bigger things on top of that. Just the whole the culture of shallowness, and I mean that's very. that's not an insightful thing to say, but just like, well, we were talking about this on about Instagram, just in general, about how, you know, we don't like it when it's hard to watch when people are so clearly like, look at me, look at me, look at me.
Yeah, I think there's something I noticed a lot myself is like really immediately identifying the difference between like what is just created as a source of entertainment and what is confusing personal life with entertainment.
Yeah.
Them saying this will get good clicks, but part of me is like, no, but you shouldn't share that.
Yeah.
You know?
So, I mean, I guess I also thought like even with actors, I feel like being an actor, kind at least being a film actor, certainly more than being a theater actor, I think, because you can't watch yourself as a theater actor. I think being a film actor sort of, at least if you have the tendency to that kind of complex of being obsessed with how you look and how people perceive you. And I just think being a film actor is a very toxic industry to go into.
More so than theater.
Very much more so than theater, yeah. I mean, film actors are really, in a lot of ways, more like models than they're like, I feel like their job is more similar to being a model than being a theater actor.
As a blanket idea for all film actors, like even with...
I think the job is a lot closer to the job of being a model than the job of being a theater actor.
You know,
obviously, acting is acting, but like the day-to-day is a lot more like being a model than being an actor. I mean, because you don't shoot a movie continuously. You don't shoot it in order.
Right.
It's you're there for a shoot.
Right, right.
Today, you're going to be standing here, and what happened right before this is blah, 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 you know?
Yeah, like you're in the kitchen, you're making dinner, but your and husband just got shot.
Yeah, we're going to get, you know, 20 takes of this 30-second shot, you know?
It's tedious.
Yeah.
It's tedious. I was always really drawn to that, and in a way still am. Like there's a couple of projects I've told you about off mic, and there's a few things I have also forgot to even tell you about already, where there's a chance to be able to act on camera, and it's still very titillizing to me. it's very something about it still is like scratching this itch that I can't quite put my finger on. Like I don't exactly know why it's still there for me, but I think it would only work if it only continues to work if it's really based on like, well, the positions were offered. Like we want you for you.
Yeah.
And I think if I were really in the dirt, as most actors are, here in Germany too, like scrapping and fighting and digging for an audition and, you know, I think it would eat me alive.
Yeah. And I think this is similar. I could never be an actor full time because if you're an actor full time, you do so much work that you do not find fun.
Yeah,
and maybe it maybe a good actor, someone who finds fun in any role, and that's probably a true statement. But, but I you know, even on stage really even more than film, plays can get really dark. I don't know, movies can get dark too. But I feel like some of the darkest things I've ever read were plays, and I don't know. I don't like doing dark things as an actor. You know, like someone.
You feel like you get too invested in it, or
no? It just makes me feel icky. Like a friend once asked me to like do this short thing where I like murder them in a shower, or or almost murder them in a shower, and then I think go you know trigger warning, go shoot myself in a truck or something. You know, it's like
so super dark,
super dark. Content, you know, of course, it's like when you're in your 20s, that's what you think art is. It's just. And it just maybe didn't make me feel good. And I didn't, when I was told that's what I would be doing, I was like, oh, okay, I guess, you know, but I'm an actor. I should be thankful to do it, you know, but looking back, I was like, I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
I only want to do something that's fun. So I think I can still enjoy particularly a stage, show to work on as an actor. I think that still does, to use your words, that still does scratch an itch for me perhaps every now and then.
But that I could imagine more for you than
but it's got to be something that sounds like fun to me. Like it got to be a part that I want to do, you know?
And if even the part of the role ended up in a dark moment, if the story is just incredible, mm-hmm. it still doesn't... Because I'm not like... I think you have a really mm-hmm. Great reason for not doing it. But if, let's say like this, you know, almost attacking and then killing oneself, mm-hmm. If that is part of a script that you're just so blown away by, does that change it for you? Or you still say, you know, I love the script, but that part's just not good for me. I just don't want to do that. Because I think I also understand
like,
that.
Like, do I still appreciate the story of it?
Like, would it ever change your decision?
If I thought the story was good, even though it was like super, super dark.
Yeah.
Yeah, I see. I don't know. I think this is related to like probably the final nail in the coffin of me deciding, you know, acting is actually not what I'm supposed to do.
Okay.
Is that for a lot of that really dark stuff, a good actor is able to access their emotions so freely.
Right.
And this is just a personal thing. I am actually not that able to access my emotions that freely. You know, whatever, be they genetic or just from childhood, I don't really have, I have pretty thick walls emotionally. And so it's there, you know, I think, this was where the time period we're talking about is like back during Breaking Bad and, you know, Bryan Cranston was excellent, of course, but I remember like watching Aaron Paul mm-hmm. on Breaking Bad and going, he can do something that I actually can't do.
I would totally feel the same way about that.
And if I can't do what he does, if I actually can't do what he's doing, mm-hmm. well, there's no point in me continuing this as a career.
That's so, man, again, that just always comes back to how absolutely admirably self-aware you are about your needs and limits and wants and this department of maturity that's just so, fascinating. And aspirational, mm-hmm. like to be able to say exactly what you just said, you know. I think I'm still somebody who, if there's someone doing something I like, there's still, for sure, in certain cases, a blind, I'm very aware that, for example, like Aaron Paul can do something I cannot. One, I would never say there's a chance. Uh-huh. Like, yeah. There is 100% no chance that I could do what he does on Breaking Bad. He is able to pull tears in such a range. Mm-hmm. And joy, show joy in such a way, like he is the actor's actor's actor. Like mm-hmm. he is just so underrated and so, he's very appreciated for that show. He mm-hmm. maybe he's rated. Maybe he's properly rated, yeah. But like, he definitely, I cannot do what he does. But there's still like, part of me is like, well, can I do what maybe like John C. Reilly does between like Step Brothers and Magnolia? Mm-hmm. Could I maybe do like what, you know, XYZ does as a character? Maybe it's like, do I have an itch for being sure. a character actor?
There are not roles in like character roles, but there are other like archetypal roles that you can fill as an actor that you don't need to go to those places. You can go somewhere else. Like your skill set it lies somewhere else.
Right. Yeah.
There's not, in other words, to put it better, there's not one skill set that makes an actor a good actor.
Right, you know? Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. You're right.
I don't know. I mean, but that's just my interest in it. But I think it makes a lot of sense that you had this epiphany and you had this realization and you broke it down for yourself. And that's where you are now. So when did you think that, and we can wrap up with this final question, but when did you choose or did you discover teaching English?
Total accident, man. So after college... So I, partly because I got some bypass credits from my high school, like I got credit for some of those classes at UNO, like calculus, for example. I had gone up to integral calculus at that school, and so I only had to take one math class, a calculus class at UNO, and I didn't take any more math, you know. So with some bypass credits and just working pretty hard, like I had my mother had an Excel spreadsheet of all of my... all of the classes that I had to take for my degree, in the order that I would take them. And I took, you know, like 15 hours a semester. And so the short version is I graduated in 3 years, which meant that, that TOPS scholarship, which is like the Louisiana, if you do well in high school, you can get you can get state money, right?
Right.
To go to college. And so, and it's called TOPS in Louisiana at least. And so TOPS sent me a letter after I graduated UNO. It was like, well,
stands for titties are pretty sweet.
So titties are pretty sweet said, hey, we noticed that you graduated. We noticed that you graduated in 3 years,
that's stupid.
But we already told you that we would pay for 4 years of college for you. Like that was part of the deal.
Mm-hmm.
So like, do you want to go to college again? And so I was like, okay. So I was like, well, I guess I'll go straight to grad school.
That's amazing. Wow. That's cool.
So I might've taken like maybe one semester off, but I went straight to grad school online.
Mm.
It was online because of like other circumstances in life. It was actually kind of a low point in life for me. Just, I moved back home to Alexandria at that
right.
time.
Right.
It was just a bad moment. And so I needed to go to school online because I also needed to be working full time. So, Northwestern State University, the same campus that I went to high school on, that university offered, some online master degrees.
Mm-hmm.
I think at that time, maybe still now, the most extensive like online grad school options in Louisiana. But anyway, wow. One of their options was English. That was pretty much the only one that I felt even remotely qualified to enroll in.
I would be the same. Yeah.
So choosing English was just, well, that's my option. If I'm going to grad school fully online at this university,
mm-hmm.
I can do English.
Yeah.
So I did that. Got that one in a couple more years, and I guess probably around, I guess I must have graduated there in spring of 2016,
mm-hmm.
and that summer I was back, I had moved back to New Orleans, and I was calling community colleges. I knew I couldn't get a job at a university with only an MA.
Okay.
So I called, I guess Delgado must have been the first university.
1-800-DELGADO.
The first community college that I called and talked to the
Delgado,
the chair of the English department, who's now the dean of the division. And she was like, yeah, send me your resume. And I started that fall in 2016.
Such an old school path. Like, yeah. I'll call the school and they want me to send them a resume.
That's how it works, yeah. With adjunct teaching, it is very old school. You just send the department, like not even an important person, like not even like someone above them. You don't send anyone in the administration, right?
Right.
Your info. You just talk to the department chair and they say, yeah, send me your resume. Okay, I can offer you an English 101 class in the fall.
Amazing. Wow.
Yeah.
And how have you enjoyed it so far? Do you think that's something you want to stick with for a few years?
So,
or do you want to get something else going on?
A great question. I kind of love this is where it's ending, this story of like the artsy fartsiness of it all, because teaching I found offer, at least teaching at this institution, which is the only institution I've taught at, Delgado Community College, offers me the creativity, in other words, the artsy fartsiness,
yeah,
the independence. You know, my supervisors really trust me, and the challenge. There have been times, more than once, where I felt like garbage. Like, I can't do this. Teaching is hard. I'm doing a bad job. Like, it's there, you know, it's
sure. Yeah, sure.
And there have been other times where I've felt like I'm soaring, you know?
Yeah.
And so that trifecta, I feel like the creativity, the independence, and the challenge. And I might add actually to that, the environment, like the faculty environment,
mm-hmm.
I'm with a faculty that I really get along with. Like, we go out and get beers at the pub around the corner all the time.
Mm-hmm.
There are several poets in my department that I hang out with regularly and write poetry, you know.
Yeah, you've created a group,
workshop
there.
Group, sure.
Yeah.
And so the community, I guess, is that other aspect. And yeah, I can see myself doing this for the rest of my life. Yeah. And continuing to get better at it. Continuing to find new challenges. I mean, AI is here now. Like, that's a big challenge that everyone
right.
in my industry is facing. I'm just going to continue to face those challenges, continue to have more and more opportunities for approaching my work creatively.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as I have the independence to do that, I love this job. Yeah.
I can't think of a more beautiful, perfectly executed line to end on, my friend. Mason Joyner, wonderful human, great friend, extremely funny person.
Back at you.
You know, I'm jealous of these students who get to be taught in your class by you, and I will always cherish these wonderful continuous years that we keep as a friendship. I'm so grateful that you can come be in my house and be in my studio and be on the show. And
the honor is mine, for sure.
It's unbelievable, man. It's so cool. I love you, buddy, and thanks to everybody for listening. And you know the drill. If you like it, subscribe, all that jazz, and have a great day. We love you. Thanks, Mason.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Look out, baby. The saints are coming.
Artsy Fartsy Immigrants, ein Podcast von John Prinz und Moritz Batscheider, produziert für M94.5.